Well, if you have your Bibles, I'd encourage you to turn to Daniel chapter 6 as we continue in our series in Daniel called Thriving in Babylon. If you don't have a Bible, that's A-okay. I will have the text for you up on the screen as well, but it's just good to have in front of you as we go so you can keep making references to it. Daniel chapter 6. It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. Now Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We will never find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel, unless it has something to do with the law of his God." So these administrators and satraps, they went as a group to the king and they said, "May King Darius live forever. The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or human during the next 30 days, except to you, your majesty, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, your majesty, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed." So King Darius put the decree in writing. Now, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened towards Jerusalem. And three times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. And so they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. "Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or human being except you, your majesty, would be thrown into the lion's den?" The king answered, "The decree stands in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed." Then they said to the king, "Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, he pays no attention to you, your majesty, or to the decree that you put in writing. He still prays three times a day." And when the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and make every effort until sundown to save him. Then the men went as a group to the king and said to him, "Remember, your majesty, that according to the law of the Medes and Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed." So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel, and they threw him into the lion's den. And the king said to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you." A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and the rings of his other nobles so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without any entertainment being brought to him, and he could not sleep. At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. And when he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions?" Daniel answered, "May the king live forever. My God sent his angel and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me because I was found innocent in his sight, nor have I ever done any wrong before you, your majesty." The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him because he had trusted in his God. At the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den along with their wives and children. And before they reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Then King Darius wrote to all the nations and peoples of every language in all the earth. May you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. This is the word of the Lord. Yeah. Well, in April 1963, only 56 years ago, Reverend Martin Luther King, along with a number of other civil rights activists, they were arrested on charges of parading, demonstrating, trespassing, and picketing in the city of Birmingham. Now, these leaders led a nonviolent campaign of coordinated marches and sit-ins targeting racism and racial segregation in that Alabama city. They did this in spite of the fact that it was against the law. You see, only 2 days before, a judge had issued a blanket injunction against these activities that they were leading. And then, with full knowledge of this, Reverend King and his colleagues proceeded to subvert the law and continue their campaign. Now, certainly, I think we would all say that racism and racial segregation are wrong and they are rightly opposed. But perhaps there are a few of us here who may question the validity of breaking the law. We might say, you know, two wrongs don't make a right. Or doesn't the Bible tell us that we need to obey our earthly governments? Well, many Christians back in 1963, they held that same opinion. They were against racism or prejudice of any kind, but they preached patience, right? Negotiation, and above all, obeying the laws set out by the authorities of the land. And eight of these Christians, eight clergymen to be specific, they wrote an open letter to the community stating this, advocating for calm, decrying the actions of Dr. King and his partners in protest for their acts of lawlessness. And in his response to these critics, Dr. King replied with an open letter of his own, which he wrote from his prison cell in Birmingham. And in it, he writes why he feels justified advocating the breaking of some laws while obeying others. This is what he wrote. The answer is found in the fact that there are two types of laws. There are just laws and there are unjust laws. Now, what is the difference between the two? How do we determine when a law is just or unjust? A just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law or with God's law. An unjust law is a code that is out of harmony with the moral law. And so I can urge people to disobey segregation ordinances because they are morally wrong. You see, even though others might label Dr. King a rule breaker, he believed that he actually answered to a higher authority, that he answered to the ultimate judge of right and wrong, the one whom I believe pronounced a verdict of not guilty over him and his fellow activists, despite other people's accusations of rebelliousness. And as apprentices of Jesus, you and I, we also answer to this higher authority. Our allegiance is ultimately to God, right? To his ways. So despite how society thinks we should behave, or even the laws laid out by the judges and governments of our land, we are called first and foremost to be faithful to God, even if it makes us look like offenders to the laws of the land, like it did Dr. King, like it did Daniel here. In today's scripture, it appears that Daniel is also a lawbreaker, But I think upon closer inspection, we see that it is God's sovereignty that empowers Daniel's subversive faithfulness. And I think that's what this passage is about. That God's sovereignty empowers subversive faithfulness. So once again, here in the book of Daniel, there is this change in leadership we read at the beginning of the passage. After Belshazzar, he dies at the end of the last chapter. Now Darius the Mede is reigning over the kingdom. And most likely Darius himself is just a regent. He is ruling on behalf of the king of the Persian Empire, Cyrus. And so Darius, he goes about setting up his government. He appoints 120 satraps as local officials, you know, throughout the kingdom. And then over these 120, he appoints three principals or administrators. And one of those is Daniel. What I find incredible is that since the beginning of his time being exiled to Babylon as a teenager, Daniel has not only survived, but he has continued to succeed in these positions of authority despite the change in leadership and rulers, right? Consider it in our own time when there's one government ruling party comes in, when they are voted out and the next one comes in. How often do people working in their positions keep their jobs? Almost never. And yet Daniel continues to be a part of the established leadership despite the change in leadership. Like us, Daniel, he lives in this quickly changing pagan society that has little to no regard for Daniel's God or for his faith. But despite being at this point in his life, in his late 70s or early 80s, Daniel is adept at not only surviving, but flourishing there. I just wonder, how does he do it? I think verse 3 points something out to us. It says that Daniel distinguished himself by his exceptional qualities, and this is why the king had planned to set him over the entire kingdom. And then this in itself aroused the other officials to fear and to jealousy. They didn't want Daniel overseeing them, and I believe it was specifically because of these exceptional qualities that Daniel has, which made the other leaders fear his promotion. In verse 4, it says that these other leaders, they looked at Daniel's life, his conduct at work, and they could find no corruption in him. That he was totally trustworthy, that he wasn't negligent or irresponsible. Now, if you're an employer, if you're the boss, it's got to be wonderful to have employees like this, right? For the king, it's got to be great to have someone like Daniel. But it's not so great to have a supervisor with those kind of qualities if you yourself are a corrupt employee. See, if you aren't trustworthy, if you're not responsible, and most likely these other satraps and administrators, they were using their positions of authority and influence for their own personal gain and not solely for the good of the Persian kingdom. Perhaps they were taking extra long lunch breaks. Maybe they were handing out favors to people in order for some political advancement or something. Maybe they were, you know, skimming some money somewhere when nobody was looking. And people do these kind of things all the time, especially when they believed that they are owed, that they're deserved more than what they're getting from their employer. You know, you haven't received a pay raise in quite some time, so I'll just take what I deserve then. Or maybe I feel like, or you feel like, you got overlooked for the hard work that you're doing, for that promotion you earned. So if you're gonna get overlooked, why bother working hard for a boss who doesn't respect or acknowledge you? But Daniel is different from other leaders. He is trustworthy, full of integrity, and it's not because he's confident in King Darius and that he's going to reward him. I think it's because Daniel has faith in the sovereignty of God. Daniel knows that God is ultimately the one who provides and will give us what we need to be content and satisfied. Daniel believes that even if he's not rewarded by people for his hard work and integrity, that God, who sees everything, will one day reward us. Daniel's faith, displayed through his work ethic, it subverts the culture because it doesn't go along with the crowd. Daniel believes God's sovereignty empowers his subversive faithfulness. And I think this is the first challenge for us that we see in this text this morning. We should ask ourselves the question, when it comes to our work or our school work, right? Are we trustworthy? Are we responsible? Or are we tempted to slack off and take what we feel we're owed? Daniel is an example of one who works with integrity because he trusts that God is sovereign, that God sees us, that he'll look after us, and that he's ultimately going to reward us someday. Well, after agreeing that there is no possibility of being able to frame Daniel when it comes to his work, these leaders, they take another tact. They conspire a way of attacking him through his faith in God. Think about that for a moment. They can't attack him through his work, but they know that they can attack him through his faith in God. And I think this tells us a couple things about Daniel's faith. First, it tells me that he must have been pretty open about his faith in God with people, including these other leaders. There's often this old adage that's credited to St. Francis of Assisi that I hear often. It's, preach the gospel at all times. Use words if necessary. And I love it. I love the sentiment of it. But here's the thing. If Daniel never used words, it's likely that his integrity at work would have been attributed by those other leaders to something other than faithfulness to God. Perhaps they would have thought, he's just trying to get in the good books with the king. Maybe he's vying for a promotion, whatever. I believe that they knew about Daniel's faith because he talked about it, and in the same way, our lives should testify to the goodness of God in all that we do, through our work, but through our words as well. The second thing that their scheme to attack Daniel's religion tells me about his faith is that it must have been pretty evident that Daniel's faith was his ultimate priority in life. It had to be. That this was not some sort of like side interest or little hobby, that he was kind of interested in God, right? Because how else would a plot to frame him using something to do with his faith succeed if Daniel's faith wasn't his greatest concern? Think about it. If Daniel had a weak commitment to God, their whole plan would have fallen through. Daniel simply could have just, I just won't pray for 30 days, right? And then he wouldn't have had to face any of the consequences. I wonder how big of a deal would it be for us if there was a moratorium on prayer for 30 days? How is our commitment to God? Well, after these leaders come up with this plan, they approach the king and notice how they appeal to his ego. They say, issue a law that anyone who prays to any god or human being during the next 30 days, except you, King Darius, that they shall be thrown in the lion's den. So they put the king on par with a god, at least for 30 days, right? Now, you might think that Darius is pretty dumb to fall for something like this. But what the English text doesn't really convey well to us is that these leaders were persistent. They came to him consistently and repeatedly, and they were kept saying the same thing. You know, people should be praying to you. Like, you are like a god. You deserve this. And I think it's pretty easy for us to imagine how a message like this could get to someone's head. And then it says in verse 7, they go in, they say, listen, all of us agree about this, your majesty. All of us, all the administrators, the satraps, all the officials, we all think this is a good idea. Except it's not true. They're a bunch of liars. There's one person who doesn't agree, right? In fact, it's the one person that the king had planned to put over all the rest of them, Daniel. But you see, this is what evil people do. They conspire in secret. They lie. And then they justify their actions by appealing to the crowd. And so we should make sure that we aren't part of any of these kind of behaviors. And also, as a church, we need to be on guard not to allow them to pervade the church as they are inclined to do. Unfortunately, though, Darius, he falls for it, right? He puts the law into effect, thus making it illegal for Daniel to pray to God, to practice his faith, and then the readers and us, we are left asking the question, what's he to do? But not Daniel. He doesn't stop to ask the question, right? His obedience is unflinching. The text says that he learned of the decree, he went home, he got down on his knees, and he broke the law. He prayed. And by doing so, Daniel performs civil disobedience. And by definition, he is subversive, rebellious, provocative, disobedient. Daniel is a revolutionary. Daniel concludes here, like Dr. King, that this law, this man-made code, it doesn't square with the higher law of God. That therefore, it is unjust. And Daniel, he's got no problem breaking unjust laws in order to be faithful to God. Daniel prays, and by doing so, he shows us that he is willing to pay the price for his faithfulness. He is willing to face the lions. Because Daniel believes in this all-powerful God. And it is God's sovereignty that empowers Daniel's subversive faithfulness. And I believe so much that it is Daniel's faith in God that and God's sovereignty that empowers his actions, because I believe we get a clear picture of this when we compare Daniel and his breaking of the law to King Darius and his upholding of it. Daniel who trusts in God, King Darius who doesn't. You see, when Darius finds out that this newly enacted law of his has been used to entrap his man Daniel, he stresses out, right? He knows the law is no good, and it says that he is determined to rescue him. The text says he makes every effort until sundown to save him. But I disagree. It's a pretty sketchy thing to disagree with the Bible, so you don't want to do it that often. But I don't think Darius made every effort. You see, where Daniel was willing to stand up to this unjust law, even at the cost of losing his life, King Darius is not. Darius's convictions, they only run so deep. Perhaps he's willing to try and negotiate a deal. Maybe he's willing to appeal through the courts, but personal sacrifice was not in the cards for him. Lose his position? I don't think so. Stand alongside Daniel in protest and face the lions alongside of him? Don't be ridiculous. See, the Apostle Paul was right when he wrote in Romans 5, very rarely will anyone die for a righteous person. So Daniel, he's tossed into the den, thrown to the lions. It's closed up, it's sealed with the signet rings, and he is left for dead. But this isn't some simple execution. This punishment was a type of ancient courtroom called a trial by ordeal. And there are a number of different kinds of trials of by ordeal. There's another one mentioned in scripture as well. But the basic idea is that the individual in question is subjected to an ordeal or a test when suspected of a crime. And if they are defeated by the ordeal, well, then they were obviously guilty. But if they emerge victorious, then they've been found innocent. And the idea in all of this is that ultimately God or the gods know the truth in ways that a human judge cannot, and they will see the verdict through. This is why when Daniel emerges from the lion's den, he says that the lions did not hurt him because he was found innocent in God's sight. And Daniel proclaims, once again, God's sovereignty saying that God sent an angel and that he shut the mouths of the lions and that God rescued him. And there is no wonder then that Daniel is willing to face danger for his faith. God is in control, even when it looks like he isn't. And that, friends, that's like the overriding theme of the book of Daniel. God is in control. God is sovereign, even when it looks like he isn't. Finally, Darius, he sees all that has happened. And then he has Daniel's enemies, along with their families, thrown into the den. It's time for their trial by ordeal. And they are found guilty. He makes this great speech. And in his speech, Darius extols the virtues of Daniel's God. In particular, his virtues of sovereignty, of supremacy. This is what Darius says. He says, "He is the living God who endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion, it will never end. He rescues, he saves." And all of these things are true about God, about our God. But what makes Daniel a hero of faith isn't that he just believes these things about God. It's that Daniel has allowed these truths to mold and to shape his life, to influence his actions. They empowered his subversive faithfulness to God. And whether it was his integrity in the workplace or his disobeying the unjust law not to pray, it wasn't acting subversive that made Daniel faithful. It was his faithful obedience to God that was subversive to the world he lived in. This is an important point. It wasn't acting subversive that made Daniel faithful. It was his obedience that was subversive to the world that he lives in. Hardly any of us would say that praying and going to church is a subversive or rebellious act. At least hardly any of us here would say that here in North America, here in our time, right? But in another time and in another place, these actions of faith may appear to an unbelieving world as treasonous. Sometimes, even in our own context, subversive faith does look like a person who goes to church despite their spouse's objections. Sometimes subversive faith is a student, the only student who bows their head in a cafeteria full of students because he or she is giving thanks to God for the meal provided that day at lunch. Or maybe they're the only student who chooses not to participate when everybody else is cheating on the test. But let's make no mistake about it. Faithfulness like this, it's going to have its consequences. It would be a lot easier for us not to go against the crowd or rock the boat, not to upset anyone by putting a toe out of line. But in the near future, subversive faithfulness to God, it might look like Christian doctors or nurses refusing to participate in physician-assisted death, potentially losing their jobs. Maybe it looks like public school teachers who follow Christ refusing to teach a curriculum that goes against God's design for human flourishing. Maybe subversive faithfulness in the next little while is going to look like pastors who are willing to lose their license or the church's charitable tax exemption because they won't perform weddings for same-sex couples. You see, we need to understand, friends, that faithfulness to God in this ever-changing pagan society like Babylon or Canada will come with trials. So in order for us to be loyal, we need to be willing to count the cost, be willing to face the lions ourselves, to pay the price. And I think for us to do that, we have got to believe in the sovereignty of God. And like Daniel, more than just believe, allow it to mold and shape our lives and our actions. You see, to believe that he is, as King Darius said, he is the living God who endures forever, that his kingdom will not be destroyed, his dominion will never end, that he does rescue, he will save, even if it means like Daniel or his friends Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego before him, that we still have to face the trial. Remember, sometimes God saves us in the trial, not from it. Right? The angel didn't save Daniel from the lion's den. The angel was in there with him. Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, they weren't saved from being tossed into the fiery furnace, but God showed up in the fire with them. And this is what following Christ demands, a willingness to suffer, even die, because we love God, and we living a truth that suffering for being faithful is far superior than living a trouble-free life of disloyalty. And this is why Jesus, he would warn all of his would-be followers to count the cost of discipleship, to know what they're committing themselves to, and to be willing to pay the price. He says in Luke 14, in the same way, those of you who do not give up everything you have cannot be my disciple. Now, remember when I said that sometimes that obedience to God, it looks subversive because of the society that we live in, right? The time and the place we live in. So it looks subversive, just praying and going to church because of the greater culture we live in. But what about when that same faithful obedience appears subversive to others within our church community as well? What about when my obedience to God, it looks subversive to you guys? Put up a picture of my friend Chuck. There's Chuck Wright. He was arrested last week in Wet'suwet'en in connection with the current conflict between those backing Coastal Link Pipeline and several First Nations communities opposing it. Chuck was there as a legal observer. If you want to know what a legal observer is, you should Wikipedia it. He was invited by the Indigenous Land Protectors, and he was arrested by the RCMP for violating an injunction just put in just a little while earlier by a judge, preventing employees of Coastal GasLink from accessing their work. Now, whether you agree with Chuck's actions or not, and whatever your opinion is about global warming, First Nations land reparations, or reconciliation, that is not what I'm talking about today. I'm saving that for another sermon. But I know Chuck. I've hung out with him. He loves Christ. And he was in Wet'suwet'en as a part of Christian Peacemaker Teams, which is an organization founded by Mennonites. And they are committed to being agents of peace using nonviolent means to attempt to reduce conflict. And Chuck was in Wet'suwet'en because he was living out faithfulness to God in his actions. Not only do they look subversive to many in our society today, but they look absolutely rebellious to many Christians as well. But friends, like Daniel, Chuck knew the consequences, and he was willing to be arrested in order to be faithful to our sovereign God. And that took great courage. And we may not agree with his actions, but let me ask you something. Do we become the lions, ready to pounce and devour our fellow Christian when their faith leads them to do something that we find subversive? When our fellow Christian does something that puts us on edge that we may not disagree with at the outset, do we become the lions ready to pounce and devour them? You see, we won't always agree with each other. In fact, we don't, and that's okay. But it's hard enough to be faithful facing consequences from an unbelieving world, let alone abuse from brothers and sisters. How discouraging it must have been for Martin Luther King while he was in prison when 8 white clergymen wag their fingers at him in public disapproval. Shame on them. And shame on us if we allow our disagreement with a sibling in the family of God to go from difference of opinion to devouring each other. You see, Jesus himself, he had absolutely subversive faith. More than upsetting the pagan world around him, he infuriated the religious establishment, who, along with the Roman government, were accountable for his crucifixion. And then look at what they said about him as they handed him over to be executed. Luke 23. The whole assembly rose and let Jesus off to Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, "We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes the payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Messiah, a king." You see, Jesus knew that faithfulness to his Father would get him killed because it was subversive to the world around him. It was subversive to his fellow Jew. And yet, he still trusted in God's sovereignty over all things and that God could even use whatever he suffered for his good purposes. And I thank God that he did. Jesus, I thank you for not allowing the fear of what the world around you would think or say or even do so that we could be shown the way and the truth and the life. And I thank you for having the courage to face the criticism and the disapproval of religious people or even the disappointment of having your friends turn your back on you and for having the faith in your Father in heaven that you were willing to face all that you did, the torture, the crucifixion, and for trusting that your Father would use it for his good purposes. And he did, didn't he? Didn't God use it for good? This is where you say, yeah. The Father used Jesus' life and death and resurrection to not only unsettle and upset the world around him, but also to bring you and I hope, to restore the world, to make all things new. And friends, this is a subversive message. And this is just what the Father wants us to do too, through our faithfulness, that we might trust in the sovereignty of God and allow that to empower you and I to take risky, uncomfortable, subversive steps of faith. Faith in a God who is sovereign. This can and should empower us to be people whose faith the world, it may not understand, but whose faith will be felt, whose faith will be heard. It's not silent in the face of injustice. Martin Luther King, he continues to write in his letter from his prison cell. He says, "There was a time when the church was very powerful. It was during that period that the early Christians rejoiced when they were deemed worthy to suffer for what they believed. In those days, the church was not merely a thermometer that recorded the ideas and principles of popular opinion, but it was the thermostat that transformed the mores of society. Whenever the early Christians entered a town, the power structures, they got disturbed and immediately sought to convict them for being disturbers of the peace and outside agitators. But they went on with the conviction that they were a colony of heaven and they had to obey God rather than man. They were small in number, but big in commitment. They were too God intoxicated to be astronomically intimidated. And they brought an end to such ancient evils as infanticide and gladiatorial contests. Things are different now. The contemporary church is so often a weak, ineffectual voice with an uncertain sound. It is so often the arch supporter of the status quo. Far from being disturbed by the presence of the church, the power structures of the average community is consoled by the church's often vocal sanctions of things as they are. But the judgment of God is upon the church. as never before. If the church of today does not recapture the sacrificial spirit of the early church, it will lose its authentic ring, forfeit the loyalty of millions, and be dismissed as an irrelevant social club with no meaning for the 20th century. I meet young people every day whose disappointment with the church has risen to outright disgust. You know, unfortunately, I don't meet young people who are disappointed or disgusted with the church, but I often meet people who have already dismissed the church as irrelevant and ineffectual to even care. But it doesn't have to be that way. Things don't have to be that way. Remember, our God is the God whose kingdom endures forever. His dominion will never end. He can save and rescue us, his church, from whatever state we're in, right? This is again where you say yes. Yeah. You see, we can be this colony of heaven. We may be small in number ERBF, but we can be big in commitment because we serve a God who is sovereign over all, who saves, who rescues. And I want so badly for myself, like Dr. King, to be too God intoxicated, to be astronomically intimidated. Don't you? And it's not too late. Remember Daniel? This guy was around 80 years old and he was God intoxicated. But it takes commitment. It takes courage and faith. But you see, God is so good. He's our Heavenly Father who knows how to give good gifts. And so he promises to supply us with these things if we will just trust him, if we will walk in obedience. I'm gonna invite the worship team to come on up at this time. Remember how I said before that as soon as Daniel learns of this decree, he goes home and he immediately gets down on his knees and prays. Like right away, he does not flinch. He acts in obedience. And I think for some of us, that is what we need to do here today, to not flinch. We need to act in obedience. We also need to respond. I think there's many of us, like me, we want to devote ourselves to being big in commitment, to being God intoxicated. I love that. To allowing these immense truths of God's sovereignty to empower us to faithfulness, even if it looks subversive. And so we don't do this often here. This is not necessarily our style, but I felt God was calling me to do this today. And as my son said, Dad, Daniel was willing to do it, so you gotta be too. I wanna invite you that while we sing this next song, that if this is the commitment that you want, that if you feel the Spirit of God has been nudging you and prompting you, that as a sign of your commitment to subversive faithfulness or for faithfulness in whatever it looks like, to raise your hand while you're worshiping, whether it's like up high or you can even have it down low. You see, we worship this God who is sovereign. And we don't have to do this. Daniel didn't have to go home and get down on his knees to pray. He gets down on his knees because he wants to show his humility and his reverence for God. And so you don't have to do this, but I'm inviting you that as we sing this great next song, that to raise your hand as a sign to our Father, that we are willing to face the cost, whatever they come, to be subversively faithful, and that we would trust in him, that he is sovereign. Would you stand with me and let's worship?